Welcome, ladies and gentlemen, to Horror in the Court. On the docket today, it's Icon versus Icon, a bout between two 80s slasher heavyweights in A Nightmare on Elm Street v. Friday the 13th Part 2. Which horror icon is more menacing and legendary? Which one represents its franchise best? Only a court of law can decide such debate. So please rise for your honorable Judge Darren Ewing.
Greetings and salutations, everyone. This is the Honorable Judge Darren Ewing. I am presiding over Horror in the Court. The latest edition takes on the argument of Freddy Krueger in the Nightmare on Elm Street franchise and Jason Voorhees from the Friday the 13th franchise. The question brought before me as a judge today is, of these two characters, who is the bigger 80s icon, Freddy Krueger or Jason Voorhees? Which of these two 80s horror film icons solidified their franchise and did so better in their debut films? So we will be talking a bit about the franchise, but primarily we're going to focus on Nightmare on Elm Street, which came out in 1984, and Friday the 13th Part 2, which came out in 1981. The reason for not using the original Friday the 13th, which came out in 1980 and featured Kevin Bacon in one of his many roles. I can't say his first because he was in Animal House and a lot of other ones. But because Jason doesn't really make an appearance in the first one, to anybody out there, sorry, spoiler alert. So we're going to talk about the second one now. I'd like to introduce or welcome to my court the two attorneys who will be defending their various characters and franchises. And the first one to speak will be the Honorable Jeremiah Johnson, who will speak on behalf of Freddy Krueger, and Scott Baer, who will speak on behalf of Jason Voorhees. Now, we flipped a coin, and we've decided that Jeremiah Johnson will be the first person to make arguments. Jeremiah?
Very well. Thank you very much. I'd like to give a good evening to His Honor, Judge Darren Ewing, for that nice introduction. And to my esteemed colleague and professional nemesis now, we've been through this a couple of times now, Scott Baer here. I am here, as the judge declared here, on behalf of my client, A Nightmare on Elm Street, who, by the time we're done today, will be proven as the shining example of its eventual franchise, thereby earning its title as the superior of the horror icons. When we talk about A Nightmare on Elm Street, we won't get that far without discussing its key character, the villain, love him or hate him, Freddy Krueger. Portrayed by Robert Englund very well, Krueger is actually synonymous with the Nightmare on Elm Street franchise and is regularly used interchangeably. We actually often hear the movies referred to as the Freddy movies. This is due to the character's strong personality, which is developed right out of the gate in 1984's A Nightmare on Elm Street. The second we encounter Freddy in this film, we know that we're in the presence of something new and original. The originality begins in this first film, but continues to weave itself throughout the entire franchise. A lot of that originality comes from the fact that in Freddy's world, the real world the victims are used to means nothing. It's Freddy's universe, and in such, he's almost omnipotent, and real world rules just don't apply. While the outside world can't do much to affect Freddy's world has a significant impact on the real world. Freddy can flat out kill you for real inside his own realm. You can have bedsheets come to life, mattresses that turn into blood geyser flowing sinkholes, and Freddy isn't even relegated to his burned flesh and bone body. He can take the form of a hall monitor, a convertible car, whatever it takes to properly psychologically torture his victims before he physically devastates them. Now, I'm not here to dismiss Scott's client. That's not my job. I admire and respect Mr. Baer and Mr. Baer's client. His client is admirable and respectable. And Scott's going to give you a lot of details to why Jason is a great villain and why the Friday the 13th franchise is, in fact, legendary. What he's not going to be able to convince you of is its superiority over my client's representation as the gold standard in its franchise and as that of a horror icon. Now, the reason he's not going to be able to convince you of that is, frankly, it's just not true. We aren't necessarily setting out to have another Freddy versus Jason argument today. I mean, I had plenty of those, around when I was in hit puberty, and I pretty much got sick of him around that time, just like I did Batman versus Superman arguments, et cetera, et cetera. However, those arguments are definitely bound to come up today. However, this is also mostly about the integrity of a single movie as the keystone to a franchise. A single viewing of A Nightmare on Elm Street should be enough to prove to all of you that in and of itself. But in case you need more convincing, that's what I'm here for. I've got plenty of material and evidence to do that. By the time you leave this courtroom today, you will, without a doubt, understand why A Nightmare on Elm Street deserves to be seen not only as the first of a brilliant original creative franchise, but the franchise's linchpin and horror's greatest. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Johnson. And now, speaking on behalf of Jason Voorhees and the Friday the 13th franchise, Scott Baer. Scott?
Thank you, Judge Ewing, Your Honor. Good day to you, Jeremiah. And a special thank you to all our listeners out there who are joining us today. I'd like to begin today by addressing the court with a quote. What if there is a boy beast running around Camp Crystal Lake? Try to think beyond the legend. Put it in real terms. What would he be like today? Some kind of out-of-control psychopath? A frightened retard? A child trapped in a man's body? That quote is from my client, the 1981 horror classic Friday the 13th Part 2. Amy Steele, playing the role of Ginny Field, shares this less than elegant thought with her fellow doomed camp counselor Paul and his friend Tom before they come to realize the horrors that await them back at camp. What she lacks in modern political correctness, she more than makes up for in brutal honesty. Let's go back now to a simpler age, to 1981. A time where horror movies still scared people, where political correctness went out the window like so many teen girl bras, where a masked man with a machete was all it took to scare an audience, win over a generation, and make us all think twice about camping. My client is here today to defend himself once and for all who is the greater pop horror icon, whose legacy as a franchise was solidified in their introductory movie. Yes, some may stop me here and say, wasn't Friday the 13th Part 1 the first Jason movie? Yes, he appears briefly in a little dream sequence, but his mother plays the main role of the antagonist, all the way to the bitter end. I'm defending Part 2 because this film introduces Jason and continues the franchise that runs for 13 films, including reboots, the upcoming prequel, and the titular Jason vs. Freddy film. He may not wear a hockey mask in this, but he is Jason. He is the unstoppable killing machine that silently and relentlessly stalks and kills its prey with no sexism or racism. Even as this movie shows, the handicapped are far from safe. He doesn't make snarky quips or play with his prey. He doesn't care who you are or what you are. He just cares that you're breathing and he aims to fix that. What's more terrifying than a killer with no agenda but blind revenge on everyone? Jeremiah will try to convince you otherwise, but his client, A Nightmare on Elm Street featuring Freddy Krueger, is not blindly killing. He is targeting the children of the killers, on Elm Street. The fear ends there. If you don't live on Elm Street, you're most likely not his target. It's that simple. But if you live anywhere near a lakeside camp or even just the woods in any state or any country, you could be near Crystal Lake. That's what terrifies me and should terrify you as well. In conclusion, Friday the 13th Part 2 is the scarier, more iconic horror film of the 80s. Jason is the real stuff of nightmares, not Freddy. Jason is the one who could be outside your door. Are you brave enough to check? To quote Counselor Mark from Friday the 13th, nothing spoils a party faster than a drunk in a wheelchair. Freddy is that drunk. Being limited to both Elm Street and dreams is his wheelchair. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Baer and Mr. Johnson. Both compelling arguments. This is going to be a fascinating debate, and I'm looking forward to hearing more on these arguments. Should we take a break?
Yeah, sure.
Yeah, absolutely.
After just the opening arguments, it's clear that Judge Ewing is facing a veritable Sophie's Choice, expected to choose between two of his clearly beloved 80s heroes. Although torn like a napkin in a ninja fight, he will persevere. He will render a clear and decisive verdict like any judge worth their salt would do.
Now then, gentlemen, some compelling arguments here. Freddy Krueger versus Jason Voorhees. Fascinating stuff. But what we're really trying to find out in this court is who is the bigger 80s icon and who solidified their franchise better in their debut film. Now, I'm going to date myself just a little bit. I am an old dude. I am known for being in at least one rather infamous 80s horror film called Troll 2. That came out in the 90s, but it was filmed in 1989. At the time that I made that movie, I was a projectionist at the local movie theater. I strung up eight. I worked at two different theaters, and I was a projectionist, a 35mm projectionist. I loved it because I got to watch a lot of movies, and Nightmare on Elm Street and Friday the 13th, Part 2, and all of their sequels played in my theaters, and so I'm quite familiar with the material and with the characters, and I was there when all of these characters came into America's collective conscience. So I do have some strong opinions, and I look forward to this discussion. So Jeremiah Johnson will begin the discussion with Nightmare on Elm Street.
The kids of Elm Street don't know it yet, but something is coming to get them.
There's something out there, isn't there?
You could just see cuts happening.
What did that, Lieutenant?
I don't know.
Tina!
What's the coroner got to say?
He's in the John puking since he saw it.
You're gonna kill me for sure.
Did you do it?
There was somebody else there.
He was locked in a room with a girl who went in alive and came out in a rubber bag.
No one knows where it came from or who it will visit next.
Nancy?
There's something wrong with you. You're imagining things.
Nightmare on Elm Street.
Do you believe in the boogeyman?
No.
Whatever you do, don't fall asleep.
No! No!
She's the only one who can stop it. If she fails...
I'm your boyfriend now, Nancy.
No one will survive. From Wes Craven, director of The Hills Have Eyes and Last House on the Left, a new masterpiece in fantasy terror, Nightmare on Elm Street.
Very well. Thank you very much once again, Judge Ewing. And I like your little almost hipster-esque callback to being there first before we were. Just I got to see him first. I got to see him in the theater. Yeah.
Well, not only that, but I got to see them before audiences got to see them, because my friends would all come over and we would string the movies up after we assembled them and watch them at midnight all by ourselves in the theater. So I saw A Nightmare on Elm Street and Friday the 13th and Friday the 13th Part 2. Before they were even released to audiences.
Nice. Right. Wow. Very cool.
Yeah. Right. Wow.
Well, that's there it is. No,
I'm envious.
I absolutely am. That would have been awesome. I remember I got into both franchises, actually. I believe it or not, I actually saw Friday the 13th, I believe, before I saw Nightmare on Elm Street. Both of those movies were, you know, big as kids. Scott and I are both children of the 80s, so yes. Those were both mm-hmm. really big for us. Both horror movie fans, but I do remember my introduction to that. My mom is a big horror movie and horror book fan, things like that. She was never really into the slasher so much, but she always was totally fine, realized I was smart enough to understand, like, that, oh, just because I see it in a horror movie, I should have killed. Yeah. I remember I was really sick one day, and I'd been into, like, reading Edgar Allan Poe. I think I was 6 years old, actually, and I was like reading Poe and these really creepy stuff I didn't get at the time, but Stephen King, things like that. And I was sick, and she was like, hey, is there anything I can get you at the store? I'm going to the store. And she was expecting, like, ice cream or something like that. And I used this as the opportunity to be like, can you rent me Friday the 13th? Because I really wanted to see that. So she did. It was great. Mm-hmm. She was like, well, I don't really like the slashers, but, you know, whatever. I know you can handle it. So I saw that one, actually, first. Nightmare on Elm Street.
And it was the... if I may interject, it was the golden era of the VHS rental companies. And it's even before Blockbuster, it's when a lot of mom and pops were renting out these VHS tapes. And there were many times, you know, we'd just get together on a Friday evening with a pizza and watch these. And a lot of times these were the only movies that were really available, were these 80s teen sex comedies and horror films. Some of them were very good. Most of them were awful, but we didn't care. But I will tip my hat a little bit. I am partial to A Nightmare on Elm Street because I think the first one is actually a very good horror film. None of the other ones are, in my opinion. But I'll go on more about that after you.
Yeah, and actually,
I've spoken, Jeremiah.
I believe it would have been 4 years old when Nightmare on Elm Street came out, so I obviously didn't see the first one in the theaters, but I did see the third one in the theaters, so I was into them by then. I don't know when that one came out, but that was
the late 80s, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. So I was still relatively young, but I got to go to the theater. I obviously had to have a parent with me to go to, but that was actually the first one that stuck out in my mind, I remember, because there were boobs in it, and I was like, young, and I was like, oh my god, I'll get to see boobs with my mom, but I get to see boobs. This is great.
There were boobs in every single one.
Oh yeah, the 80s were great with that.
Yeah. Yeah, it's what I remember most about the 80s. Boobs in every movie, man. Yeah,
pretty much.
It was when they were getting excited about that. But I digress. I'm here, I'm supposed to be talking about my client, A Nightmare on Elm Street, not my childhood. Although, you know, this is hopefully making me more personable to the jury that we don't have.
Or they get
as we've established, like, sucking up definitely is not against the rules.
Okay, yeah, absolutely. So I guess most people are probably at least aware of the general nature of Freddy Krueger out there, but I'll give a little bit of background on the plot pretty quickly. It's pretty easy to synthesize these plots in a few lines for most of the movies we actually talk about here, because with the exception of maybe last time, which was Feast v. Ravenous.
Yeah, those actually
a little bit more complicated. But these movies are, you know, slasher films generally do not require a lot of plot. That's kind of one of the points, is you just have mindless slashing through slicing and dicing.
It's a formula.
Yeah, absolutely. And although, you know, I will go into some detail about how the Nightmare on Elm Street actually was able to break from that formula. But I'll go into a little bit on the background of the movie first, namely the plot. It's real quick. Creepy child molester guy. Parents don't like him. Decide to take law into their own hands. Essentially, murder him, burn him in a boiler room, I believe. And yeah. He decides to take revenge on these parents in the best way that he knows how. It's very sophisticated, actually. He decides to go ahead and take revenge out on them by getting to their kids, and where the parents, the one place the parents cannot protect them, which is in their dreams, in their sleep. That pretty much is 7+ movies worth of plot right there. That's it. for 7 movies, but you don't have to improve on that. That's pretty great.
His death, by the way, at the hands of the parents in the film itself was kind of a spoiler.
Yeah.
If you think about it, like that they don't put that on Front Street when you start the movie. Mm-hmm. It's like 3/4 of the way through when she's talking to the main girl, when she's talking to her mom.
Her mom's like, why the hell is this guy
horrible?
Why is this guy trying to kill us?
It's actually like a Shyamalan twist you get, like, oh, it's your parents' fault.
Yep.
But then now everyone knows that. But back then that was actually like a twisty spoiler.
Thanks, Mom, for Christmas, you know, Becky's parents got her a BMW. You got me a murdering child creep guy in my dreams trying to slash me up. Great. Thanks, Mom.
And we also find out, I think it was in part 2 or part 3, where one of my favorite lines in horror movie history, we find out a little bit about Freddy Krueger's history, and she says he's the bastard son of 1,000 maniacs.
Right.
And I think, you know, if I'm ever introduced to royalty, I would like that to be how I'm introduced. In fact, I remember we just howled with laughter when we heard that. Because, like, you know, most of the sequels just weren't very scary.
I forgot about that line.
But, yeah, you know, so we do know a lot about Freddy.
Yeah, they actually did a very rich background for him over the course of all the movies.
I want that on a business card.
Bastard son of a thousand
yeah.
maniacs.
Like Jeremiah, web programmer and bastard son of a thousand maniacs. It could work. It could probably work for some people.
Don't forget part-time lawyer.
Yeah, that's right. Part-time lawyer. That's another thing I get to add to my resume.
Yes.
So one of the things I wanted to touch on, and one of the reasons I'm bringing A Nightmare on Elm Street to the table as kind of the superior of the franchise between this and the Friday the 13th. As I said, I absolutely love the Friday the 13th. I should actually point out too, one of us decided to take the high road in our opening arguments. The other decided to crap all over the other. I don't want to necessarily say who's who, but if you listen back, folks,
me where I compare your movie to someone in a wheelchair.
Yeah, and I said, I believe I used the word admirable and respectable in mind. So, you know, I don't know. High road, low road.
Don't worry. You be the judge. Worse.
You be the judge. All right. You know, one of the reasons I brought Elm Street to the table and Freddy as the scarier, the more iconic, the better, especially the better a representative of the franchise, but I'll get into that, is I'm really into the way that the film specifically was made as transitioning between the reality and the dream states. Because when you watch this one, I can't remember as much. I think it's not as subtle in the follow-ups so much, but this one specifically does kind of set the bar pretty high for that. And Wes Craven probably has a lot to do with that. He was the director of this one, and I don't think he touched another one until the New Nightmare.
The producer too.
Yeah.
Until the reboot.
Yeah, and I think he helped write an original draft of number 3, and then he did New Nightmare, which was the one where it's sort of like in reality, but then everything goes crazy.
Oh, that's the meta one, right?
Yeah. That was the next one that he actually got involved in as a director, I believe.
I had issues with
writer.
That because yes. It didn't fit for me, you know, franchise-wise.
It was out of that, but also taking Wes Craven's history into play, like, the reason he created Nightmare on Elm Street like this is because the slasher genre was getting a little bit dull, no thanks to, I don't know, Jason Voorhees and the like.
There were a lot of retreads of Halloween, the 79 Halloween.
Yeah, exactly.
There were.
Including Friday the 13th.
Yeah, and I would even go back.
I'll admit that.
I would even go back, you know, one more to, I mean, we had enough of these, you know, and I understand, you know, maybe, you know, Jason was only the 15th or 16th of them, so they thought maybe they were still being, I don't know, like, original at the time, but he was the 15th or 16th, like, giant behemoth lumbering speechless dolt that just went around, like, and the original one that I'm thinking of is Town That Dreaded Sundown. And actually, if you recall, in Nightmare on Elm Street, Friday the 13th 2, Jason actually didn't even get his trademark hockey mask at that point.
No, he's wearing the burlap sack with a hole for the eye.
Yeah, and the difference between him and the guy from Town That Dreaded Sundown is he has one hole.
Yeah.
And the guy and it's more for like a burlap sack instead of like a pillowcase. But you know, that aside, I'm being a little more like a little more animosity now that I heard your opening arguments. I can be a little, like, gloves are off now. So going into you know, what really made this nice is Wes Craven was looking to kind of break some of the rules, and he did that again, I think, with New Nightmare, but even before then, before New Nightmare, I think Scream came out before then. He's been trying to rewrite, you know, not necessarily franchises, but formulas
horror.
A little bit.
The
yeah.
genre of horror.
Yeah. And Nightmare on Elm Street really does rewrite a lot of that because it violates, I believe, a nice quote I'm not going to actually quote here, I don't have it written down, but I just remember reading, somebody said that he moved the goalposts a lot. He would set a goal, move the goalposts, and usually that's a big no-no in a lot of movies, but because he kind of set that as the standard in this movie right off the bat with, you know, trying to, like, make people think that it was going to go one way and then kind of rewriting the rules as the movie went on. So you're like, I don't know what to think. I guess I just got to roll with it. One of the things I know that he took a page out of Psycho, and he wanted the opening character, if you recall, Tina, has that dream about Freddy in the boiler room coming after her. She wakes up right off the bat. You assume she is going to be the heroine. It's actually kind of like the Drew Barrymore as well in Scream. And you know, so he actually, he said that he intentionally took a page out of Psycho and tried to make it seem like it was going to be a one main character that actually ends up dying before you expect them to. And then of course somebody else takes over. And actually, not to throw back to last month too much, but in, 2 months ago, Feast, we talked about kind of the same
kind
of like
same thing. They played with all the tropes.
So, you know, he was moving the goalpost out throughout that. And one of the reasons I think he got away with that is because it had so much to do with the dream states. And we all know that our dreams don't really have these kind of rules to live by. And if they do, all of a sudden something seems to be going normally, and then all of a sudden something's wacky and your best friend turns into a butterfly and, you know, jumps off a balcony or something like that. I'm not saying that's a dream I've had, but that would be kind of a weird one. So the transition between the reality of the dream states is one of the things I wanted to bring to light as evidence of just its superiority. Friday the 13th franchise, or in the movie Friday the 13th 2, you know, the death scenes are, they're clever, they're creative for that kind of thing, but it's just like, oh, is he going to use a claw hammer this time or a machete? Oh, whereas Freddy, well, let me just actually say a couple of things we've got here. The first death scene really is Tina, actually, and she is killed by invisibly in front of, so you actually only see what's happening in the real world, not in her dream, and by Freddy, but her boyfriend is watching as it happens, and she is pulled up by this invisible force up the wall and actually finished off upside down on the ceiling.
Yeah, that's a spectacular death scene. It's probably one of my favorites in all of cinema. It's just out there. It's inventive.
It's really good.
Yeah. And then later, actually, I remember one of the creepiest things that always stuck in my mind with that movie is then later when her friend, after she's dead, sees her in the dream right before the no running in the hallway or whatever part, the hall monitor, you see like the body kind of sliding across the ground being pulled once again by an invisible force, and the legs kind of tip up, and you can see it as if a ghost is dragging this body across the ground. It's so freaking cool. But
and it's in the trailer. Of course, everybody knows Johnny Depp gets eaten by the bed.
Right. Yeah. That would be the
apparently the
blood geyser sinkhole mattress. Yeah.
Yes.
Right. And it's still 10 times more entertaining than Mordecai.
The funny thing is, when I originally, it was, you know, about a month or so ago when we, you know, decided, maybe a little more than when we decided to go with these movies here. And I was like, oh, good. I get to use like Johnny Depp as, you know, some of my like fodder as some of my evidence as to why I like, oh, introducing Johnny Depp. And then like, now, like, Mordecai came out, and everybody's like, another flop by Johnny Depp. I'm like, I'm going to go ahead and play down the Johnny Depp thing a little bit.
I think a wise move, because Mordecai and The Lone Ranger are the last Johnny Depp movies that I've seen, and I'm just getting it's making me a little weary, honestly. I love Johnny Depp.
Yeah, me too. His good stuff is great.
The last thing I saw him in was Tusk, and I got to say, I loved his performance in that. It was so different.
I would love him to go back to eating Gilbert Grape type of thing, and not just they're sort of treating him the way they started to treat Robin Williams. Let's just pay him a bunch of money, wind him up, and let him do his thing. And you know, he's not making as good a choice as, say, one of his contemporaries like Leonardo DiCaprio, or he's very good. He's worth every penny they pay him. But the Depp shtick is really starting to make me wish that he'd stayed in that bed.
Well, I think that that's the thing with like something like Mordecai getting so ridiculed, but him having such a good long rich history behind him, is I don't think he's about to be ruined by a single movie or five or six movies, but hopefully it's enough that berating that he'll be like, wait a minute, maybe I do need to step back and do a reinvention.
Well, he is
take
doing
a couple of years
because of that. Mm-hmm. He did Transcendence, which was also a flop.
It was a flop, yeah. And it wasn't as bad a movie, but
now
he's
exclusively just doing those Kevin Smith horror movies. He did Tusk already. He's in Yoga Hosers currently. And I think he might even be in the third one of that series.
But I think he needs to get like to he needs to get like back to the more like indie drama, I think, stuff that
I like him in horror movies.
He's good. He's good, but I think he's gonna still be like a caricature
character. Like it's like Jack Sparrow in Pirates of the Caribbean.
Yeah, yeah.
His character in these movies is Quebec Canadian like PI.
Yeah, and I think
it's actually a really over the top character that he plays well.
But I think like what needs to happen is he needs to play less over the top characters. He needs to stop being such the character actor that we get for wacky things, like you were saying, like Robin Williams style.
Yeah. But I think he's forever cool. I think he's forever golden.
Oh,
I think he's like Sean Connery at this point. If you look at Sean Connery's filmography, most of it's pretty bad.
Yep.
But it's not going to hurt him one bit.
Effing Connery, because you'll always give him a chance next time because he could turn it back around, or even if not, he's still Sean Effing Connery. So
I think it's time that we turn the argument over to Scott. Do you agree? And then we can do a little back and forth.
Have you met all your points?
Sure. I did want to just a couple of random little trivia bits just because they're really fun here.
Absolutely.
Because I always liked ending on a little bit of trivia here. First, I did want to, but yeah, the transition between the reality and dream states is what I was getting at before we got a Johnny Depp tangent there. is that what I really like the fact that Wes Craven was able to direct that as if you kind of like how when you fall asleep, you have a transition between the conscious and subconscious. And you don't notice because it's really absolutely impossible to notice because your conscious would have to be aware of drifting into your subconscious and crossing over.
Right.
Wes Craven did a really good job of directing that in this film. And I feel like that was actually part of the terrifying thing because it's really familiar to all of us is if you wake up, or I'm sorry, if you go to sleep and you end up in your dream, not necessarily aware that it's a dream, but it's really realistic in the same setting. I've had those where I fall asleep and I'm mm-hmm. in the same setting. And in your subconscious, it's actually thinking like, oh, I'm actually in real life right now. And that's really terrifying. So that's why, like, one of the things that I felt is one of the most terrifying aspects of this.
Like those dreams when you're a kid and you dream you go to school and have a school day and then you wake up and you have to go to school and have a school day.
Oh, my God. Those were the worst, yeah. No, I just did this.
I used to have those and it just bugged me so bad as a kid.
Yeah, because it would be like a really long dream where, like, you would go to every class and you would do, like, all your crap and you'd have to go wave your hand and go to the bathroom.
And,
and
at one point you're feeding, like, a duck in a tree.
Yeah.
Just it makes sense. It's your school day, but...
So here's a couple of trivia things. There is a weird connection between the Nightmare on Elm Street films and hopefully we all remember the 80s television. I used to love it from TGIF, I think. Just the 10 of Us. Do you remember
Just
that show?
Just the 10 of Us.
Remember? Like,
no.
Oh, my God. Really? Oh, it was a classic. It didn't last for that long. But I mean, but probably by today's standards, probably a while. Like 4 seasons or something like that on TGIF.
Okay.
There was, it was like two, it was very Brady Bunchy, like five. God, was it all females or just five females? I remember being like 9 and 10 and just thinking these were like the hottest girls in the world, but they were, you know, they had like a group of women living in this, it was kind of Brady Bunchy. But anyway, randomly, there's a really crazy connection between Just the 10 of Us, that random 1980s television show, and Nightmare on Elm Street. Starting with the first one, the actress Heather Langenkamp, Nancy, played the overly religious daughter, Marie, on Just the 10 of Us. In Nightmare on Elm Street 2, one of the kids trapped on the school bus in the film's beginning, Joanne Willett, played by tomboy daughter, played the tomboy daughter Constance Connie Lubbock on Just the 10 of Us. Nightmare on Elm Street 3, The Dream Warriors, Heather Langenkamp reprised her role as Dancy. The Dream Master number 4 featured actress Brooke Thies, who played the sex-crazed Wendy Lubbock on Just the 10 of Us. In the film, she portrayed a bodybuilding girl who got transformed into a cockroach. I love
that.
Oh,
yeah.
And then, like, her arms, like, were splitting and everything. The practical effects in every one of those movies, whether they're good or not, were awesome. And lastly, the family's son on the show, played by Matt Shackman, used to wear a Nightmare on Elm Street t-shirt depicting Freddy Krueger that was featured on several different episodes of the Just the 10 of Us show. Now, the second piece that's kind of runs through a popular culture, and I actually wasn't aware of this, but I guess Sam Raimi and Wes Craven have a little back and forth, like ping pong type thing going where they try to reference each other in some of their movies. In Nightmare on Elm Street, Evil Dead can be seen playing on Nancy's TV in one scene. Wes Craven, Sam Raimi have this ongoing thing of referencing each other in movies. It started when Raimi actually put a ripped Hills Have Eyes poster in the cellar at Evil Dead. And then Wes Craven put Evil Dead on the TV in Nightmare on Elm Street. And then Sam Raimi then put Freddy's glove in the tool shed in Evil Dead 2. So there's
Nice.
So there's been like, they've actually done like an intentional little back and forth. I like the little trivia bits you can get out of some of these movies. I was unaware of both those bits of trivia, especially the Just the 10 of Us. That's just weird. I don't know. Somebody must be like a nephew or somebody that like of a producer of a New Line Cinema or something. I don't know.
Yeah. And I'm Sam Raimi and Wes Craven, I think are both terrific directors. So that's, that's a nice bit of trivia there.
Yep.
All
they
right,
apparently they respect each other. So
yes. Now, keeping it real, as it were, and moving out of the dream state, we are going to now shift our attention over to Jason Voorhees from Friday the 13th.
On a June night in 1980, Friday the 13th, 12 of her friends were murdered. Why should Friday the 13th, 1981, be any different? Friday, the 13th, part 2. The body count continues. 14.
You're doomed. You're all doomed.
15.
God.
16.
Much like Jeremiah's movie A Nightmare on Elm Street, this early 80s iconic film, Friday the 13th Part 2, can be summarized quite easily. It's basically...
Kill!
It's basically a bunch of teens at a camp, and they get killed.
Sometimes get naked, then get killed.
The funny part is when I was rewatching
Boobies.
This...
Yep. It's booby time!
Honestly, that is exactly what this movie is.
Should've
it
called
doesn't
Friday
hide anything.
Booby time?
No, the weird part about this series, this whole franchise, is that every one of these movies starts with a recap or at least some kind of prequelish type information to carry the story forward. This one, I think, has one of the longest cold openings in cinema history.
I didn't realize it hadn't started yet. Like, I just rewatched
it's like 15
it, you know,
minutes in before and the
then
title
also, like,
comes on the screen.
Comes in. I'm like, I thought that happened. I assumed it happened already.
Oh, no. You just follow, what's her name? Alice from the first film, the lone survivor. Yeah. And you're just going like through her routine at home while after she has like nightmares that give you the clips from the first film that are relevant, which is basically the mother killing people, her having to run in with the mother, and Jason jumping out of the lake.
Jumping out of the lake is one of the coolest creepy scenes. I love it. It's like zombie-esque. Oh, God, love it. Oh, so good.
Oh, man. We just popcorn flew in that scene the first time. It was terrifying. It was very effective.
And it's weird
time I saw it.
Right.
It's weird that they're saying that didn't even really happen, that was like part of a dream, that technically Jason was never there to jump out of the water. Like, they even add the cop in part two, where the cop's like, we didn't find a boy in the lake.
Yep.
And they're, you know, just they kind of basically retconned it where, you know, that never happened. It's all in your head, but he really is alive, so. Basically then we jump forward in time after Alice gets killed, and it's a bunch of camp counselors coming to a camp near Crystal Lake. Not the same camp, but really, really close. And one by one, they get picked off over the course of, I think it's just a day and a half. It's really quick.
Yeah, it's a lot. And how many did you do a count? I can't remember.
The body count was... Because
in Nightmare on Elm Street, it wasn't crazy. It was like three.
It was 12.
In part two, it was 8 people, but you have to count Alice at the very beginning who gets killed. Wait.
Part one, I think it was 11, actually.
In part one, it was 11. In part two, it's 8 plus Alice.
Yeah,
so it's 9.
Yeah, 9, yeah.
So it's actually a lower body count, which breaks the Wes Craven Scream rules for having a higher body count
for
second
everyone.
Film.
Right, yeah.
Oh.
That's interesting.
Yeah, because in Scream, he lays out the rules of horror movies for sequels, and it definitely does not meet its body count.
Right.
I like the way they're referencing Wes Craven as if he's like some superior director or something
he did make rules, though, that did kind of set a standard, and they were based off of 80s franchise films.
That's true, yeah.
Right.
And this one
defied
all of Wes Craven's set in stone rules.
I just walked into that one.
I also have to mention, as everybody in the first Friday the 13th, another actor is killed in bed, and it's Kevin Bacon. So you got Johnny Depp dying in the first Nightmare, and you got Kevin Bacon in the first Friday the 13th, and they both get killed in bed.
Yeah.
So I don't even know where I was going with that.
I know. You know what? I believe we've got to be able to make some kind of connection out of that. Some Kevin Bacon-esque connection to that. Yeah.
Yes.
Well,
it's a degree.
I
mattresses of separation.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, And you know, when I'm not being a judge of horror in the court, I'm also an actor. Still, they still let me do that. And I don't know why. And I always like to point out, and I'm not comparing myself to any of these great successful actors, but I always like to point out, because Troll 2 is, you know, just so iconic, and I'm notably bad in that bad film. But Johnny Depp was in Nightmare on Elm Street. Kevin Bacon was in Friday the 13th. Jennifer Aniston was in Leprechaun. George Clooney was in Return of the Killer Tomatoes.
Yes.
You know, Texas Chainsaw Massacre, what, two or three? You've got the two Texas, Matthew McConaughey. That,
yeah. And Renee Zellweger.
Renee Zellweger. Yep. So, you know, everybody, you just own it. And again, I'm not comparing myself to any of those people who are actually good.
You're pretty much saying you're the next George Clooney is what you're saying.
Yes, exactly. That's what I'm saying. I'm the next George Clooney or Johnny Depp.
Yeah. Yeah. Objection for some reason. Yeah.
But in my actual movie, there was no one who turned into a major star from it. In fact, the only person I actually looked into from two was the girl Terry, the one who you see early in the film with the booty shorts, the Daisy Dukes, where the camera lingers Michael Bay style on her ass for really long time.
I think it actually Michael Bay did that, whoever his name was, style.
Steve Miner.
Steve Miner style. Miner style, baby.
Yes, it's all Miner style. But yeah, that was a lingering shot.
There was a boy named Daisy Dukes.
It was a lingering shot in a scene that had no dialogue, because even when the guy took the slingshot, which people carry slingshots around, I don't know. When he hit her in the butt with a stone, all he did was like smile at each other creepily and then like part ways.
Yeah.
Because that was Scott in the movie. Scott and Terry.
Oh, what do you know?
And Scott was a bit of a horn dog and a creeper.
Oh, what do you know?
Yeah.
I have a theory.
Jeremiah's a prophet in the Bible.
You just piqued my curiosity, because this was during VHS. Now, we all have, we're familiar with the pause moment now, because we can pause things. Uh-huh. But when you used to pause a VHS, it was all blurry.
Yeah.
I'm not saying that I ever rented VHS tapes and paused them in specific scenes because I wanted to see something.
Of course.
But I, yeah.
Honorary.
I noticed, I mean, there's even which is not a horror movie, but like Fast Times at Ridgemont High, there is a nude scene, and it was directed by Amy Lederer. It was directed by a woman, and the shot holds on I think it's Jennifer Jason Leigh for a very long time.
Yep.
So in the 80s there was a lot of that. Whenever you had some pieces of female anatomy, the shots would hold longer. I guess because
make it pause worthy.
While you were watching the movie, you were like, oh well, hello. I mean,
yeah.
It's just a theory.
Anyway. Well, you could also tell where those moments would. I mean, not that you wouldn't know anyway, especially as like a pre-pubescent and pubescent boy when I was watching these movies, wouldn't think about pausing them anyway. But you could tell, even if you didn't think about it, because there would be like a warble in the tape because it would get rewound and paused so many times that it would actually fit. You know, nowadays we live in the world of digital where you can, you know, it doesn't degrade the quality if you view it over and over again. But back in those days, if you rewound a certain area, or if it was viewed more or paused more,
you would destroy
kept there,
it eventually. You,
yeah. Mm-hmm. So you would have these like areas where all of a sudden, like, you know, these very clear pause-worthy moments would be a little bit degraded for some reason.
And being the classic 80s movie that it is, it does have more scenes than that. Actually, that same character is the only one to show her breasts in the movie. Terry, when she goes skinny dipping, she takes off all her clothes.
So what you're saying is if it's a scene without boobs, is going to be a good hold on
Daisy
Duke's butt.
That was another nice long
gonna be
hold.
Boobs and butts, actually. That's it.
And
Friday
the 13th. Do you guys remember the characters Sandra and Jeff? They were the ones who actually went to Blood Lake with Crystal Lake got
You know
renamed
what's funny?
Too.
I actually remember characters based on how they're killed, honestly.
Okay, they
movies.
Were the ones who were speared together.
Okay, yes, yep, I do.
Yeah. Okay. Okay, that scene where they got speared together, and a lot of people don't know this, I had to dig and find this. I wondered why they cut it so awkwardly. They're definitely about to have sex. And there's a very hard cut when they're about to, and then it comes back to them post-sex, hugging and getting stabbed. Mm-hmm. They had actually shot that as a full sex scene. It was going to be the only one in the entire movie. And the reason it got cut was because after filming it, they found out that the girl that played Sandra was underage.
They
had to cut that entire scene essentially and leave it just to
go
the...
back in time and not shoot it maybe.
Apparently at this point in time they weren't doing very detailed contracts. They actually asked age or made them show ID.
Louise.
So they had a full-on sex scene in the movie with an underage girl accidentally.
All
right, well this is, and
that makes sense because it was around that time. I'm really gonna embarrass myself. There was a porn actress named Tracy Lords.
You can embarrass me too because I know this story. Yeah.
And she was infamously one of the biggest porn stars of that era. And she lied about her age. She started doing these kinds of films when she was 16. So it made her a much bigger commodity. But it was easier to lie about your age. As an actor, it's the same thing. They ask, have you ever shot a rifle or ridden a horse? And you say, well, yeah, of course, they do it all the time. And then if you get cast, you go off and get a lesson. But now, they could just look on their phone and say, oh, well, I see that you actually have never done any of that, or you're this age, or, they can find that stuff out.
Yeah, you're a dirty rotten liar. Yeah,
yeah, exactly.
You know.
Yeah,
I see you used to pause Fast Times at Ridgemont High at the...
there's no reason to pause there. The scene lasts for a long, long time. Yeah. It's kind of disturbing for me, but anyway.
That was as much fun as it is to talk about all the naughty bits of this film. There's two things I actually wanted to bring up about Jason himself and how he kills and... what I really think works for this film and kind of pushes it above others in the same genre and in neighboring genres is there are a lot of scenes in this film that are done POV style, point of view.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And a lot of horror movies before, after, and during this time period were not experimenting with this. And there's something about that whole walking in the head of the killer.
Yeah.
And mm-hmm. Literally there are scenes where you will see him holding the knife in front of the camera. In nowadays terms, it's almost like there's a GoPro strapped to this person as they're killing them.
And it's interesting they did that back then because I think it's almost like the way that the director, the writers know that a lot of the reason, people watch these movies a lot of times for that kind of thrill or that kind of thing. It's not that people are demented and want to go kill people, but there is a little bit of that thrill rush that comes with being inside of the
this is really
getting to me psychologically. This is a place I haven't been before,
and especially since he doesn't have a trademark weapon like Freddy Krueger with the claws,
right?
You're seeing POV of these boots walking in the grass, and then you see the hand reach down and pick up a hammer or a machete, whatever's laying around the house, essentially a kitchen knife in one scene. He can find, he's like, oh, that's a weapon.
Yeah. Also they use shadows. Sometimes you'll just see a shadow of the weapon.
Yep.
Before it happens, and that's very effective
A lot of suspense in that manner. Yeah. There was one shadow in the movie, and I can't remember where, but he's wearing a Freddy style hat. Like a fedora.
Yeah.
And it's on the shadow, but it doesn't make sense for any of the scenes because it shouldn't connect with any character. There was the Ralphie guy, the Nazi guy who got killed in he was the second person to die. He wore a hat, didn't he?
Maybe, I don't know.
But I wonder if they use him as a stand-in for a shadow at one point. Yeah, he's definitely a messed up shadow.
I gotta wear my hat. It's one thing in my contract. I gotta wear the hat. It's my thing. People are gonna know it's me. I gotta speak about hats. I know I can't. It's in poor taste to go back to my movie right now, but I gotta do this. Did anybody else find it funny that in Nightmare on Elm Street, if you recall, before she goes and gets Freddy for real, she's like, I can bring parts of him out of here, out of my dream, because she comes out with his hat. And she's like, I know it's his because his name's on the inside. Does anybody else find it weird that Freddy Krueger writes his name on the inside of his hat? It's just writing it on your underwear. It's just so weird.
It's probably on the back of his shirt.
I don't want this bitch to steal my hat. That's my hat. I know. It's my name on it. No, it's a weird green hat.
It's probably on the inside of his glove.
Blood stain. Yeah.
Property of Freddy Krueger.
I don't want to forget my hat. Forget my underwear. My name's in there too.
I'm sorry, that was my Freddy Krueger impression. No, I think his mother probably wrote that down before she was raped by 1,000 maniacs.
That's right. Right before. He's like, well, I just want to make sure my son has his underwear.
Freddy,
and his hat.
You don't want to forget your hat, darling.
Yes. Now, close the door. You're going to hear some things.
I got to go change the bedpans at the insane asylum.
Oh, my God. All right.
You know, Jer, before I mentioned that Wes Craven set out those horror rules.
Right.
And this movie obviously broke the one about sequels where the body count wasn't higher, but it's still made for a good suspenseful film.
By two, it was,
Well, he also made the rule in the first Scream that if you do drugs or you drink, you're a victim. What I love is
sex,
in this
drugs,
movie,
drinking, right, like that
the
kind
night
of, thing,
of the massacre, the group splits into two groups. Half of them go to the bar, half of them stay in the cabin. Everyone at the cabin dies. Only one person from the bar dies. Because everyone stays at the bar and drinks, including the Tom guy,
who
leans over to that old bald guy at the bar, and he's like, you know what about any after-hour clubs? And of course, this like 70-year-old bald guy wearing like a 70s disco shirt's like, yeah, just nods and smiles.
Right.
That's the man to ask about a teenage party.
Actually, it probably is. Of all the people who know where every teenage party is that creepy fucking 70-year-old in the corner. Yeah.
But once again, this movie breaks the rule. Like, everyone who goes and gets wasted at the bar lives except for Paul. And even Paul, it's kind of ambiguous as to whether he died. The main counselor at the camp.
Yeah.
Him and Ginny are running around at the end fighting Jason everywhere pretty much. Inside the cabin, inside his shack, outside on the grounds, in the car.
How do they kill...
And Paul just kind of disappears.
How do they kill Jason in this one?
They don't.
They don't think he's dead?
Jason grabs Ginny through the window in that iconic slow motion grab scene where he doesn't have a mask on. He's just all deformed.
Right.
And then he pulls Ginny through and it fades. And then all of a sudden she's on a stretcher being put in an ambulance. And Paul isn't around. And Jason's not around.
Right, yeah.
And then it goes to the cabin and shows his mother's head.
Yeah.
And there was an alternate ending that was never shown in theaters where the head, the eyes open, and it smiles. And that was supposed to be a cue that Paul was dead. And I can see why they didn't air that, because it's really confusing as all hell and makes it kind of cheesy. So basically just showing the head at the end was supposed to symbolize that Paul's dead.
Right, okay.
And in the next one, you see Ginny in the stretcher, and they talk about eight people dead, and that would make Paul number eight.
Okay, yeah.
It's also kind of funny, if you look really closely at the end, they put Ginny on the stretcher into the ambulance backwards, and they don't close the ambulance doors when they take off.
We'll just let her float down I-72 for a little while.
It is the worst ambulance crew ever. They put her in feet first, and they don't close the doors.
I don't want to do this paperwork.
Found a couple of extras over in the bar. Right? Yeah. Hey, you guys want to make $50?
Yeah, what are we going to pretend to know
these
how to...
white shirts on.
Yeah.
They had enough money to rent the ambulance, but not the actual medical
crew. Yeah, they're just like, oh, crap. Does anybody know anything about ambulances? Well, I know. I don't know.
We'll shuffling just do one of the compartments.
I don't know. Are you supposed to shut the door or not shut the door? Just go with it, man. It's good.
Been in the back of a cop car a couple of times, but...
Close enough.
And there was there's one other 80s trope that this movie didn't go with. There are two non-white actors in this movie. There's a black camp counselor and an Asian girl who has glasses.
Yep.
And they're in a lot of scenes, but they stay at the bar and don't die. And this is still, at this point in time, we're still in like the Star Trek age.
That's early,
Like in Star Trek, if a guy had a red shirt and was African American and went down to the planet, he was dead.
Oh, he's dead.
Yeah.
Period. And this point in time, we were still living on that. Like, it was still happening in movies commonly.
Yeah, And it was definitely a slasher movie trope. I mean, there's slutty girl, drug-doing teen.
Oh, yeah. If you smoke pot, you're dead.
Any minority. Right. Although it was funny, the first one to break the minority stereotype was actually Night of the Living Dead in, like, 19...
That was later in the 80s.
60, whatever, but yeah.
And if you were a virgin, you lived.
Yeah, well, yeah, exactly. You're supposed to be innocent, sweet, and actually, it's funny because in A Nightmare on Elm Street, I actually think, not to, you know, kill my argument any whatsoever about, like, Wes Craven going against a lot of the grain, but he actually stuck a little bit to some of those rules. I think he maybe thought he had to, because if you recall, Tina, who we thought maybe, like, the heroine, because she's the one that wakes up dreaming of the boiler room,
getting rid of her first.
Yeah, but she goes in... to the you know, she, like the room where, I can't remember the guy's name, you know, the like a derp, hey oh yeah, we're gonna bone, and then they go and they have sex, and they make
Tony from Full House.
sorry, that's not Full House, it's Who's the Boss.
Oh, Who's the Boss, I'm sorry.
Yeah, it was Tony from, Tamanta, oh,
that's a good Tony.
Yeah, that's all you need, A-O-O-A, Tamanta, A-O-A, yeah.
Just turned into Danza right before our eyes.
Oh, man, he went full Danza. Yeah, actually, you know the funny thing about that, the guy that played that Italian guy, he was actually a Hispanic actor, and his agent changed his last name for... To get the role, because he was like, you can play Italian because of your like the color of your skin.
Really?
They're not going to hire a Hispanic actor. You can get a role as an Italian. Yeah.
Really?
Yeah. That's Ron. Wow. I think his name was, or whatever. He got strangled in the jail cell. And mm-hmm. Yeah. Yep. Yeah. He had to play an Italian guy because there were just no roles. They wouldn't hire. He assumed, or rather his agent assumed, they're not going to hire a Hispanic actor, but they'll hire an Italian.
Right. Yeah, well, there was the movie 16 Candles, you know, the actor who plays Long Duck Dong.
Mm-hmm.
His real name is Gary Watanabe, and I only know about him because he grew up in my hometown of Ogden, Utah. But when he went in for the audition, he told them that he was, I think he's supposed to be Korean, and he went in and just played it that way because he didn't want to tell them, yeah, I'm from Ogden, Utah. And at the time, the white population in Utah was like 99.9% white. So, you know, he didn't want to tell them that he was from Ogden, Utah. And I only remember that because that's my hometown. So that sort of thing happened quite a bit too. Lying about your age and about your ethnicity.
Yeah, no, that's it. Hollywood, baby.
Now, to be honest, I think that actually wraps up most of my case.
Yes.
I do have one piece of evidence I'd like to enter into the court, if that's okay.
I'll allow it. Yes.
This is a Wikipedia entry.
Oh,
and
you killed me on a Wikipedia entry last time.
And all this is doing is to illustrate just how scary real life camp is, and the fact that these movies do illustrate a good point that over the years, there have been many deaths related to camps, and with this past week, I'm not sure when this will actually air, so this may be dating myself a little bit, but I had to comb through 70 years of notes and facts and numbers, and what I've come to is that camps have actually killed 1.1 million people in the last 70 years. And
wait, like, you mean like...
I am counting Auschwitz.
Okay.
I am currently on the Wikipedia page.
You're going to erase the numbers no matter what.
Yeah, I believe the second you bring...
I am using Auschwitz because as of Monday...
Don't send your kids to Camp Auschwitz.
My point. As of this past Monday, it has been 70 years since the closing of that camp.
Yeah.
And if we include that in
type
my...
of camp.
If we include that in my statistics from that point on, there has been 1.1 million deaths due to camps.
And how many due to beds? I'm curious.
Yeah.
By comparison.
Yeah. What I'm saying is... is camps kill, and
right.
And yeah. This no, movie no. is no, no exception.
Concentration camps kill. I can add to that easily. You're not getting your bear argument from last time back into the show. Okay? You're not pulling this one out.
Camps kill.
All right.
Oh,
all right.
Boy. All right. Well, very, very, very good arguments, both of you gentlemen. I'm going to go into chambers, and I will return with my verdict.
Who will emerge as the victor? Will it be Freddy Krueger with his haunting claws? Or the MacGyver of the macabre, Mr. Jason Voorhees? Who'll use anything in his environment to devastate his victims. Judge Ewing is deliberating in his chambers as we speak to answer such quandaries.
Well, thank you both Jeremiah and Scott, Mr. Johnson and Mr. Bear, for your arguments. This was a very, very difficult decision for me. because of the parameters of the arguments that you're trying to make, I find myself rather torn in making my decision. The purpose for this hearing was to determine who is the bigger 80s icon, who solidified their franchise better. Everybody knows who Freddy Krueger is. I think most people know, if they don't know the name Jason Voorhees, they certainly are familiar with the Friday the 13th films. I'm almost positive more Friday the 13th films were made than Nightmare on Elm Street films. Am I correct?
You are, yes.
All right. But the other issue that I struggle with is, because we're essentially talking about horror films, I also want to bring in which is scarier, like which of the franchises are actually scarier. And this is where I'm torn. I think the very first, A Nightmare on Elm Street, is terrific. I think it's frightening. I think it's well directed. It was really a shocker for us. It was very exciting. But it's because the character Freddy Krueger was very much in the shadows. You didn't really see him all that much. And when you did, because he was burned to death by their parents, the makeup was, he looked burnt. He looked ragged. When he became a star, all of the other movies, Wes Craven produced them, but he hired very slick young MTV video directors to do them. So Freddy really became kind of a quipster, almost like an Arnold Schwarzenegger type character that just made a lot of bad puns. His makeup was more stylized. It almost looked like a mask. And I think with the sequels, Freddy Krueger just became not scary. As a matter of fact, I just hate number three. I just hate that movie. So I think Freddy Krueger is not as scary because of how they handled his character later on, because it became, you know, it's brightly colored and brightly lit, and it doesn't put you in an uncomfortable place. Now, as Scott mentioned, with Jason, you are put in an uncomfortable place, and they do establish that the rule book is out. We don't care if you're handicapped or, you know, whatever. It's one of the elements that makes the Texas Chainsaw Massacre such a frightening film, such a classic horror film. So if I had to pick a bigger 80s icon, it's Freddy Krueger. But I think if you have to pick a scarier 80s icon, because Jason did become scarier with subsequent films. He became more mysterious. They kept the mask on him. When they pulled it off, he was hideous, and you had to look away. And as Scott mentioned, you know, that really could happen, but haunting you in your dreams is also a very scary thing as well. So I'm kind of hung. I'm a hung jury right now, because I think Freddy Krueger is the bigger 80s icon, without a doubt, because of Englund's wonderful over-the-top performances. But I think Jason Voorhees is a more frightening character. So, I don't know. Gentlemen, what do you think?
Are we looking at a mistrial?
Are we looking at a hung jury?
That's what
decision?
This may be a mistrial. I don't know. I've been given these parameters, but
this could be a first.
Yeah.
I mean, well, it sounds like, as far as the two stipulations we brought to the table, you're equally split between them.
We each won one of them.
That's it.
That's so true. That's true.
So we're both losers.
We're both equal.
You're so cup half full.
Think of it as you're both winners. And, and once again, you know, this is what I like about Horror in the Court, is that just like the Fresh Prince of Bel-Air, we learn something at the end of every episode.
What we've
learned on this episode is that camps kill. So we're There's a takeaway. We're helping people. So I feel very good about that.
I never expected for anybody, for you to interject, any of us, to interject Fresh Prince of Bel-Air into Horror in the Court. So we all also learned something today.
But
just
it is
like
welcome.
Fresh Prince of Bel-Air. Absolutely, it's welcome. Absolutely, it's welcome.
But, okay, so truth be told, if you had a Nightmare on Elm Street, all of them, and all of the Friday the 13th movies, and you had to watch one, or you wanted to, we've watched them, you wanted to watch one, what do you think you would grab?
Ooh.
Well, I mean, I'm, ooh, yeah.
I'm split on that, too, because I would pick Friday the 13th to rewatch because of a lower level of familiarity. I'd like to rewatch because they're a little foggier in my memory. But nightmares are more keen in my memory because I love them more as a kid.
And the other thing, even the bad ones are really fun because, like, the death scenes and all, and you know, like, you hit the nail on the head when you, like, he became this, you know, pun hitting quipster Freddy Krueger, which, you know, they definitely were not as good films and they were not scary to speak of, really, after the first one, you know, but they were clever and fun. They did run with the
I enjoyed them.
People took their kids to see the Nightmare on Elm Street sequels.
True.
Right, yeah.
I know. I was in the theater, but no one would take their kids to, Friday the 13th. But the Friday the 13th is very clearly a ripoff of Halloween. And they all were. I mean, a lot of those slasher films were. So Elm Street gets points for giving a really clever twist. But the 13th films, I mean, every single one of them, as far as I know, has made money. And
They got to be cheap. I mean,
I thought Jason in Space was kind of fun.
I actually really liked that one.
I did too. I really liked it. I thought it was going to be terrible.
I own it on DVD at home.
I
love the holodeck where he finds the two camping girls and like kills them in their sleeping bags, and they do the hologram just to keep him busy.
Yeah.
And I remember. I can't remember which 13th it was. I think it's the third one. But there's an actor named Johnny Timko, and this is before I did Troll 2, but we named him the worst actor of all time before I was given that dubious distinction. And he's the one that he's the kid in the sleeping bag, and Jason just grabs him by the feet in the sleeping bag and just whacks him against the rock.
Oh, yes, I love
just
that.
Just whammo. He's like, gone.
It's just like styrofoam in a sleeping bag. You can tell. Yes. Oh, my God.
So they're all, to go back and watch them, and also really to watch them make what my friend Zach Carlson, who works at the Alamo Draft House in Austin, Texas, he calls that real filmmaking. He really opposes digital filmmaking. And he, with all of these films, everything had to be, you know, like you mentioned, Jeremiah, these had to be practical effects. These had to be things that either played on your imagination or they had to actually portray them. And they did some really fun, clever things, the practical effects people with these movies, because it all had to be in camera, so they had to use just the tools that they had. They had the shooting and editing to tell the story. They couldn't, some people call it cheating. I don't think that's fair, but they couldn't go back and redo it. If your orderlies ended up putting your star into the ambulance backward, and you got back and you were watching the dailies, you know, later
couldn't
that day,
you couldn't
see that, and you couldn't go back and reshoot it,
digitally slap doors on the back of the ambulance like you could now. You're like, oh, you know what? Just plop some doors on there with digital. And actually, some were done better than others. I got to say, again, I don't want to crap on my movie so much. It was done absolutely, like, some of the practical effects in Nightmare on Elm Street were really complicated because, it's not as simple as just a machete to the head and all the stuff that's been done before. There was weird stuff I was reading when the arms get really long and he's, like, scraping across. they had like two people on each arm with like fish wire, and they had the glove hooked up to a car battery to create the sparks and all that. Really cool stuff. Huh. But yeah, then you've got the last scene, which is the one that's supposed to hit, like, stick with you. And it's when the mom gets dragged through the door. Yeah. And it just like, it, I'm pretty sure you could see like Barbie's plastic legs, like, in that, because it's the most, it's like the most stiff plastic crappy practical effect I've ever seen. And it's the one that's supposed to like hit with you. It was right after like the convertible turns into like Freddy Krueger, and it's like, mm-hmm, this is amazing. Yeah. And then there's just like this little Fisher Price doll getting ripped through a freaking window plastically. And it's, yep, like, you know, sometimes they're done better than others. I don't know why, right, that one was what was allowed. But again, yeah, they saw it and they're like, oh, well, we can't redo this. And also, it was really low budget. The first Nightmare on Elm Street, they were like, they weren't expecting it to be the franchise that it is. They,
right,
hoping,
yeah, Wes Craven had done The Hills Have Eyes, which is an excellent horror film, the original.
Yeah,
excellent horror film. But, you know, he wasn't a proven, he didn't have a proven track record for making a lot of money. So, yeah, they did what they could with the budgets for both of them. And I'm happy to report that Steve Miner, who directed Friday the 13th Part 2, is still directing and still pumping things out.
Good.
So, yeah, you know, no sad stories. In fact, he did Lake Placid, which was one that I really liked. And
I liked that one. That was a good one. Yeah, that was fun. It was fun. Again, fun.
Right.
Killer. Stuff.
Yeah, and Craven, as everybody knows, he's landed on his feet pretty well.
He's done okay for himself, yeah. I think he could have retired right after the Nightmares and lived on that money, so nice that he's,
probably, yeah.
It's nice that he's actually, like, tried to maintain some integrity and reinvent and things like that, like, you know, as he goes. He loves his craft, you know? He loves the, mm-hmm, the writing, he loves the horror genre, he loves what he does, so...
Yeah, and speaking of craft, I want to mention that we didn't do a show in December. Yeah, how was that for a segue, huh? Pretty good, huh?
Well, yeah, it was great. It was great until you just mentioned the segue.
We'll fix that in post. We'll digitally fix that.
Yeah,
in post.
Exactly. We'll do that what Wes Craven couldn't do. Yeah, we'll fix that ambulance gurney right now. Yeah.
Yeah, I apologize. We were not able to do a Horror in the Court for December. It was just a very, very busy time, and this is where I get to name drop a little bit. I've been in 4 Christmas films. Just small roles in these made-for-TV movies. But in a sheer act of vanity, I looked up the Nielsen ratings because I work in television. I'm a producer. And that's my day job. And I was on 25 million television sets in December with my combined 4 very Christmas nice movies.
That's a reason. That's a reason to miss. Films. That's a reason to miss Horror in the Court. That's okay.
Yes. Yeah. And the new one was on the Hallmark Channel, Christmas Under Wraps with Candace Cameron Bure from Full House. And the most exciting thing for me was I got to work with Brian Doyle Murray, who is one of my idols, one of my icons. He wrote Caddyshack.
Yeah.
And yeah, absolutely genius. So there, that's my name dropping, self-promoting portion of the show.
And what Thanks a segue. So. Beautiful.
Thank you. Thank you. Well, gentlemen, another good day in court, I'm going to not put down my gavel because I didn't really make a decision. It was this one's a mistrial, but well done, both of you.
That concludes this month's episode of Horror in the Court. Tune in next month as two ambassadors of the fantastic, a genie and a leprechaun, face off in Wishmaster v. Leprechaun.